Welcome to Marilyn Solutions with Reverend Marilyn, the speaker for the new millennium. Join Marilyn as she talks with guests offering a wide range of talents and information. And now, here's Marilyn.
Welcome. Glad to have you here today on Solutions with Marilyn. We have an exciting program planned for everybody. And I want everyone first to know our phone numbers in case you want to call in and talk with our person today, Glenn Mullen, who has studied and lived with the Dalai Lama in Tibet for a period of 12 years. He was in school there. And the call-in numbers are Pierce County, 253-584-1480. That's Pierce County, 253-584-1480. And in King County, it's toll-free. Just pick up your phone without any toll charges or dialing a 1. Call 253-804-5765. Call 253-804-5765. I'm so glad today that you are here with us. Glenn Mullen is the author of 14 Dalai Lamas, A Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation. And before we have a chance to talk with him, I want all our listeners to know that Peter G's Fine Carpet and Upholstery has joined us in being a sponsor of this show. And please give him a call at 253-862-0993 and find out what amazing things he can do if you are needing carpet cleaning, especially with spring coming on. Crystal Voyage is still with us sponsoring our program. She has a wide selection of metaphysical items for you to choose from. A real wonderful treasure chest over there at Great House Square in Tacoma. Join her, Crystal, and all her wonderful items for you to look at and share and purchase. Olala Recovery Centers is continuing their sponsorship at 1-800-882-6201 for your recovery needs. Check out and go see Olala Recovery Centers. You'll be very impressed with the quality of work they are doing in addictions. And the Healing Tree is in Auburn for your wellness center and another metaphysical store, but closer to you maybe if you're in the Auburn area. Their number is 253-876-9585. I want you to suggest to everybody that you visit that sponsors this program. You heard them on the air. They'll be glad that you're listening. Now I would like to introduce Glenn Mullen. He studied engineering as a youth in Canada and traveled to the Himalayas to join the Tibetan Studies program at a small college for Western students that was established by the Dalai Lama. He stayed there for 12 years, completing the rigorous training in Tibetan, Buddhist, philosophy and meditation at the school and at a monastery. He then joined the Research and Translation Bureau of the college, known as the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. Glenn has painted a portrait of the varied and fascinating Dalai Lamas and the dozens of previous lives of the soul that became these 14 extraordinary beings. I'm sure that you'll be really interested in purchasing his book, 14 Dalai Lamas, A Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation. And we'd like to have Glenn help us out with some of these questions we have today. Glenn, are you there?
Sure am, and glad to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the invitation. Can you tell us, Glenn, how you became fascinated with Tibet and Buddhism?
I think like many people who come to their destiny in roundabout ways, it's really an accumulation of many little things. And in the beginning, my mom was British and her dad had been a major in the army in India, so he had connections with India and the Himalayas. And as a teenager, I was in a rock and roll band. Our lead guitarist had just moved over from England, and he was a practicing Zen Buddhist. So after that, I started reading a lot of Asian materials and eventually came to the Tibetan and just fell in love with it. And shortly after that, I heard that the Dalai Lama was opening a college for Western people in India. So I left Canada and went over and joined it.
Well, that was fortunate. It was just worked out at the right time.
Yes, it was the early 70s, and the Dalai Lama opened it in 1971. I heard about it a few months later, and the program that I joined was started in 1972. and I remained in Darmstadt until 1984.
For those of who don't know where world geography very well, Glenn, could you explain where Tibet is and its role in Central Asian history?
Yeah, I think Tibet is, you know, in the West we tend to think of it as just a kind of small little Shangri-La-ish place, like a hidden valley in the Himalayas. Actually, the landmass of traditional Tibet is as big as Western Europe combined, all the countries of Western Europe combined. So over 1.25 million square miles of land. So large, large piece of property. And in addition to being at the very heart of Central Asia, its culture dominated, its spiritual culture, mystical culture, dominated not only Tibet itself, but the 25 or so kingdoms of northern India, like Ladakh, Lahul, Spiti, another Sikkim, Bhutan, and so forth, much of western China, and all of eastern Russia, the like Buryat, much of Siberia, the Mongol republics, and so forth. So it played a very important role in Asian history for the last 700 or 800 years.
Well, that's fascinating. excuse me. What exactly is the Dalai Lama in the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism?
The early Dalai Lamas were great spiritual leaders, and starting from the first, who was born in 1391 and lived till 1474 or 1475. And he was born as a simple in a simple nomadic family. And so a very, very, very earth-linked family, and of no grand social standing, to say the least. But he became a monk when he was a young child, and by the time he was 20, became recognized as one of Tibet's great sort of spiritual scholars, Buddhist enlightenment scholars. Then he did 12 years of retreat and achieved his enlightenment and became one of the great spiritual characters of Asia. So after that, his reincarnations basically all had a bit of a head start, because they were all regarded as the reincarnation of this one who had established such a great legacy. The early Dalai Lamas were purely spiritual roles, whereas from the fifth Dalai Lama in about 1642 or so, that role was supplemented with a kind of a temporal chieftainship or kind of chief peacemaker in the country or something like that.
So they've had a lot of political emphasis then also, besides just the spiritual?
Yeah, not in our sense of the word political, of course. I mean, that was an ancient society. Tibet wasn't really a country in our modern sense. Really what it was a federation of maybe 300 or 400 small countries, all with their own kings and chieftains and other types of leaders, and loosely under the Federation of Lhasa, with the Dalai Lama as kind of a figurehead leader of that whole conglomerate. And obviously it worked pretty well, because for 350 years until the Chinese invaded, it remained in place and remained very popular, and today is still the most popular symbol of Tibetan unity and Tibetan identity.
So you're saying it actually is a group of different areas that have their own independent rule?
Yeah, Tibet was very much a laissez-faire kind of a country. Each little valley had its own king and also had its own spiritual leader or leaders. And nomadic tribes had their own, you know, chieftains and the such. And each of these groups had a pretty well an autonomous life. It was under the loose affiliation of Lhasa and the basic spiritual temporal guidance of the Dalai Lama.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think it's actually it kind of makes a picture of how peoples can live and get along without one ruling another or one being totally usurped by another.
Well, I think that sets a good example. Our United States originally was, so to speak, that concept, but it hasn't really stayed that way.
Right. America originally was supposed to be a federation of states, and in the end, with every passing president, the states became less significant and the center more significant. So in reality today, they should just dispense with the states altogether, because they just absorb taxes and don't really do anything. I mean, they have no power left anymore. It's federal law always holds precedent over state law, always holds precedent over municipal law.
Huh. Correct.
So they really should just cut out the middleman and have, you know, federal government and municipal governments.
Well, that makes sense. That's an interesting idea. A lot of bureaucrats might not agree, however.
Yeah, they'd have to get a job.
That's right. Well, we're going to be coming back in a minute and finding out how the Dalai Lama is identified and chosen. So if you are interested in calling in with a question of Glenn, he'd be glad to answer as best he can about the Dalai Lama and the spirituality of the Tibet. Pierce County is 253-584-1480. And in King County, toll-free, 253-804-5765. We'll be looking for your phone call. The lines are open, and we will be back shortly. Thank you. Welcome back to Solutions with Marilyn. We are having an interesting conversation today with Glenn Mullen, who has written a very fascinating book called 14 Dalai Lamas, A Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation. First, I'd like to make sure my listeners are aware that I personally am familiar with the people that sponsor this show. Peter Gies has been to my house and did a fantastic job of cleaning up some rug problems that I had, and I was very thrilled with the results of what he did. I do know that Crystal Voyage later this month will be starting to handle my angel art work. I was very thrilled when she was so interested to purchase for me quite an extensive display of angel art, and that will be available later this month for your interest and to go in and see if there's something you'd like for your home or a gift. Olala Recovery Centers, I have been there, I have taught and lectured over there, and I know that they're doing a good job from my personal observations. And the Healing Tree is a wonderful store and can help you with your wellness center if you're looking for alternative ways for healing. And they also have items that are of metaphysical nature that you can also purchase in Auburn. So let them know that you heard about them on the air, and they'll be glad to let you come and participate of whatever services they have. If you wish to reach me for counseling, intuitive readings, classes, or to contribute to keeping this program on the air, call 253-845-4907 or email me at Marilyn, M-A-R-I-L-Y-N, at angelicasgifts.com. And I do have space in my classes Thursday, tomorrow night. We have some openings that occurred. And if you are still interested in classes, you can email me or still continue to call me. And you will only have missed one class, which isn't that much, so you can still join us and have a good time with spiritual classes of creating a conscious contact with your higher power. So if you are also interested in sponsoring this program like our other sponsors are, call the station KLAY at 253-584-1480. If you are wanting to call in on our free lines, we still have some lines open. Pierce County, 253-584-1480. And King County is 253-804-5765. Glenn, we're glad to have you here today.
Well, thank you very much, and wonderful to be here.
Well, I've been really excited about this program because I have been following the Dalai Lama. I have four of his tapes where there was an interpreter that explained many of the things about the Dalai Lama's philosophy, which I wanted to ask you about later.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen a couple movies where they had the fellow that lived with the Dalai Lama for several years
mm-hmm.
that was in the movie theaters. I thought that was a terrific show. And how do they identify the Dalai Lama and choose that particular person?
Well, the idea of tulku, or officially recognized reincarnation, is much bigger than the Dalai Lama himself. There were, in the old days, something like 3,000 reincarnate lamas, great men and women who, when they died, a committee would be formed to search for the reincarnation. And this still continues today, that the diaspora that followed the Chinese communist takeover, of course, many of these were lost because he didn't have the luxury of putting together so many search committees all the time. At any one time, you know, with 3,000 reincarnates, at any one time you've got 40 or 50 of these guys who are out there in the bardo floating around and reborn to look for us. They do the same with all of them. Watch the body of the old one at the time of death for signs of where the reincarnation would take place, or have people who are good at reading natural omens, sort of natural psychics, to see if any omens occurred that would indicate a place of rebirth, and then wait for about 9 months after the death or a year after the death, and then start looking in that area that was indicated for children born with auspicious signs. Usually things like the lines on the hands and the feet, ears are big signals, forehead, things like this. Tibetans say, look at your body, you can tell your past lives. Look at your mind, you can tell what's in the future for you.
Interesting.
So with all 3,000, they'd search for the reincarnations, and then when they got down to a short list of potentials, showed them a bunch of stuff that had belonged to the previous one, and see who could recognize what. Because the Dalai Lama was such an important toku, more care was taken with the search for his reincarnations, but the process was much the same with all of them.
Oh, that's fascinating. Who was the first Dalai Lama, and what did he do?
Well, the first was actually never known as the Dalai Lama. The Dalai is actually a Mongolian word, because when, in the old days, Mongolia was this sort of great military force. And in 1578, the one we now know as the third Dalai Lama was requested to go and teach in Mongolia. And the Mongolian king became a Buddhist, and then that Dalai Lama gave the rule that the Mongols had to give up living, if they wanted to be practice meditation and be effective in the Enlightenment quest, they had to give up living by rape and pillage and get an honest job. And so his name was Sunam Gyatso. Gyatso means ocean. And in Tibetan, in Mongolian, Gyatso translates as Dalai. So rather than call him Ocean Lama or Gyatso Lama, they called him Dalai Lama, translating his name into their language. And so from that time on, the Dalai Lamas have always been known as the Gyatso Lamas have always been known as Dalai Lamas. Until this century, no Tibetan ever called the Dalai Lama Dalai Lama. It was always Mongols, and then the Chinese used it, and the British learned it from the Chinese.
Okay, so now the first Dalai Lama then was strictly spiritually oriented? Is what you're saying?
Yeah, he was a young child who, when he was 7 years old, his father died, and he was one of four children. And after the father died, it put the mom in a difficult position for raising all four by herself. And in accordance with Tibetan tradition, she had astrological charts and divinations done on all of them. And it indicated that he would be best put with an uncle in Nartong Monastery, one of the great monastic training schools of the day. And so at age seven, he was placed under the care of his uncle in that monastery. And as I mentioned earlier, by the time he was 20 years old, had become the rising star of all of southwestern Tibet, and by the time he was 40, became the most beloved personality in Central Asia. And he lived to a ripe old age, dying in his mid-80s.
So they tend to have long lives?
Several of them had quite long lives, yeah. Some also, the later ones, died young, particularly in the 1800s, that whole bunch of them all died young, probably because Tibet for the first time went from being a remote cut-off area to having a lot of traders going back and forth, and they were all given audiences with the young Dalai Lama, so it exposed them to a lot of international illnesses that obviously had their effect.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, that kind of happens.
Tibetans don't mind, you know. The Tibetans look at it when they, like, you know, the 10th Dalai Lama or 11th Dalai Lama, they died, you know, very young ages, but they'll say, well, even though he only lived till he was 10 years old, nonetheless, the deeds that he accomplished were so magnificent and wonderful that even if we're one to write for 100 years, you couldn't capture the many things he did in a single day.
Well, that's a very positive
and then
approach.
Say, now, when he was 9 years old, he saw that he had trained enough people for that lifetime, and he saw that others needed a good lesson in impermanence and the truth of death and dying, and therefore, in order to elevate their minds and tune them into reality, he collected together his various activities and drew them back into the clear light radiance of infinite being.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they talk about it that like that.
Well, it's a really positive approach.
But in my book, The 14 Dalai Lamas, The Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation, with the latter Dalai Lamas, I give a fair amount of information on the searches for each one, who was in charge, how they went about it, where he was born, how the tests were conducted. Sometimes there were controversies about the different children showing promising signs and how those were resolved, things like that. So it tells an interesting story. Whether or not it proves reincarnation is not really so much the point of the book, but it's really just, I think at the very least, Tibetans have a highly developed science for identifying child protégés, because not only with the Dalai Lamas, but with all the reincarnate Lamas, they always turn out, or they generally turn out very, very exceptional, 99% success rate, I would say. And compared with ordinary children, where a success rate is probably, you know, 5% or something, so.
Well, that's interesting.
And by the way, people interested in the book, A 14 Dalai Lama's Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation, you can order it through your local bookstore, or else you can just phone Clear Light Publishers in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at 800-253-2747. That's 800-253-2747, and order directly.
Oh, that's good to know. I'm sure people will be interested in getting your book.
What? Well, actually, just today, I received a message that it's one on the short list for the NAPTRA, the prestigious NAPTRA Award for inspirational biographical books of the year.
Well, congratulations.
Well, it didn't win yet, but it's on the short list, so keep fingers crossed.
Well, we can also pray for you.
Also that, yes.
That's even more significant than crossing fingers.
Well, every part of the body and mind have their own little benefits.
That's for sure. Why does this spiritual leader's soul choose to return to human form over and over again?
Yeah, that's a very big question. The Buddhist idea is that ordinary people take reincarnation by necessity. You basically have driving forces of karma and delusion, like attachment to other people and places and things and whatnot. This pulls you back. But after you achieve a certain level of spiritual maturity, then you don't come back out of compulsion anymore. Instead, if you come back, it's in order to uplift and benefit the world. So the way it's said in the traditional text is they abide in the infinite sphere of the great peaceful void, but out of compassion manifest in the world in order to uplift and benefit mankind. So it's a kind of a vow or a precept in Mahayana Buddhism in general, that as long as there are living beings, as long as there's suffering in the world, may I continue to come back and try and help and add and contribute.
What a wonderful motivation. We could all learn from that one.
And in Buddhism in general, but in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, great emphasis is placed on that. They call it Zhenju Semgi Kunlong, the inner perspective of the enlightenment attitude, that everything, when you get up in the morning, you say, may everything I do today contribute to the uplifting and happiness, only to the uplifting happiness and joy of others, and may I do nothing that in any way harms or confuses them. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you say, may everything that I've done well be dedicated, may the good karma from that be dedicated to the joy and upliftment of all other living beings. And may nothing go to harming them.
Well, that's a beautiful way to start and end a day. In Pierce County, call 253-584-1480. And in King County, call 253-804-5765. It's your questions for Glenn. He has some interesting information here that maybe you have not been aware of, and we're learning today with Glenn. So give us a call. We'll be back shortly. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're talking today with Glenn Mullen, author of a book about the Dalai Lama called 14 Dalai Lamas, The Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation. First, I would like to inform my listeners that if they would choose to contribute to this show, some kind of contribution to keep the show on the air, I'd be glad to take whatever recommendations they have for a topic that we haven't covered yet and they're interested in hearing more about. This is your opportunity to do that. You can call me at 253-845-4907 or email me at Marilyn@angelicasgifts.com, and you can be part of the program from your side of the airwaves also. I would like to inform my listeners that next week we have a lady from Seattle, Kimberly Clark Sharp, who has written a book about her near-death experience, and she's lives in Seattle and will be glad to be with joining us and sharing her exciting experience. The following week, we have Ned Dougherty, who has been traveling around the United States sharing about why he was able to predict the September 11th disaster. And this was before it happened. His book came out the spring before September 11th, and his prophecy was in there. I'm sure you'll be interested in hearing how that came about. So keep staying tuned to this show. There's lots of good information and interesting kinds of knowledge that maybe you won't hear any other place. Glenn, we're glad to have you here today. And you made a reference as to the Dalai Lama's having historical influences in secular and government affairs. Do you have some examples that you could share with us?
Usually their roles were that of peacemaker between various factions of Asia. Dalai Lamas have always, first and foremost, been great spiritual leaders. And so their political roles in the physical realm of social structures really were much more in the avenue of coming between conflicting factions and trying to talk some sense in them, using their weight and the respect that they receive from both ends as spiritual leaders to negotiate some sort of peace settlement. For instance, with the Manchus, who took over China and ruled much of East Asia, including Korea for a time, they were often at war with various Mongol tribes. Now, both Manchus and Mongols were practicing Tibetan Buddhists, but still, kings are kings and territory is territory. And they would occasionally have wars. And so whenever that happened, their peaceful living broke down and war resulted. Usually the Dalai Lama would try to send representatives to both sides, send envoys of monks to both sides and try to get them into a kind of a Camp David somewhere or a Camp Buddha somewhere where they'd sit down and talk about the differences and iron out some sort of settlement or treaty. So this was true internationally from the time really of the third Dalai Lama onward and right down until today. For instance, the border areas of eastern Tibet, there were many different Chinese warlords. We think of China as one country. It was usually also 10 or 12 different factions, either completely independent or owing just very minimal, nominal kind of allegiance to a given emperor or king. So whenever they would have problems over anything, usually peoples would call on the Dalai Lama to come in and try and talk some sense into them.
Well, that's good that we have some people that are capable of bringing on a more harmonious peace gathering.
Well, I think that's also continued even with the present Dalai Lama. You know, he's always been a kind of a voice of sanity in Asia throughout this lifetime, even with Tibet being under China. For instance, all during the 70s and early 80s, he went to Russia many, many times and, you know, met with the top Russian leadership on his way in and out of Mongolia and all of eastern Russia, which is Tibetan Buddhist. And I think he played an important role in bringing Russia into a more sensible and more humane attitude of living. And it's very interesting, the picture of the Berlin Wall being knocked down, that was in Time magazine, spray painted on that were big words, long live the Dalai Lama.
Interesting.
So on the Berlin Wall as it was coming down. It's kind of cute. And I think in many ways the Berlin Wall came down in some small part at least because of the message of humanity that the Dalai Lama had spread up in that part of the world.
Well, isn't it amazing how one person can make such an influence?
And I think it's also had a lot of benefit here in America. You know, we were a little bit more of a harsh peoples, I think, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And, of course, many factors go into it. The Dalai Lama is just one of many factors in the big soup of international life, but he's a very positive factor. He's like, the exotic spice that goes in that gives the soup the little je ne sais quoi.
Well, that's...
And I think he's really, you know, he's brought a lot of benefit. I mean, he's been to South Africa, and he's a good friend of Bishop Tutu.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever he goes, basically, he spreads the message of peace and people living in harmony and learning to get along.
Oh, that's what we need.
You know, he does it all the time, and we still will see people occasionally erupting in violence here and there because not everyone has the karmic predisposition to listen, and sometimes negative conditions will be such that violence will erupt. But in general, he's, I think, made a great contribution.
I know he has. If you are listening today to Glenn Mullen, please call in at Pierce County. Our phone lines are free, 253-584-1480, or King County, 253-804-5765. And find out your answers that you've been curious about. We'll be glad to answer them. Glenn, what happened to the Dalai Lama who lived to be only 9 years old?
Well, those were four different Dalai Lamas. The 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th Dalai Lamas all died young. And that's from roughly, during the 1800s, last part of the 1800s. Well, the first 75 years of the 1800s, basically. And why they all died young has never been officially stated from the Buddhist side or Tibetan side. It's just that in their short lives, they had all the time they needed to accomplish the greatness that needed to be accomplished at that time. More suspicious peoples look to perhaps Chinese Manchus as, you know, poisoning them so as to get greater power in Tibet, or perhaps it was some internal Tibetan faction, you know, pushing and pulling in power politics. It's hard to say. My own view is probably it was just the increased, in terms of the external condition that facilitated those young passings, probably was just the increased international travel through Lhasa in the 1800s brought in a lot of childhood diseases that the earlier ones hadn't been exposed to.
Well, that's...
You know, because if anyone showed up in Lhasa, they were given an audience with the young Dalai Lama. So he was meeting people from Iran and Russia and China and whatnot. So it was the colonial period, the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone was, you know, Russia was expanding at the rate of miles every day in the east, and England was capturing country after country. So everyone was basically spying up in Tibet to see who could do what.
What was your life like in your 12 years of study in the Tibetan college and monastery?
It was really very, very, very wonderful. Just absolutely fabulous. My house, my window opened up onto a 17 or 18,000 foot high snow peak, and the sun came up from behind it every morning at 7 or 7:30 and came in through the window and landed on my bed and woke me up. A very pleasant way to wake up in the morning.
Very picturesque.
And then usually get up and go to the first, get up and meditate for an hour and a half. Then start doing the various study classes, usually three or four different classes a day. And then some debate when I went to the debate monastery, then debating for 4 or 5 hours a day. And then in the evening, meditating for another hour or two. Generally morning and evening, between an hour to an hour and a half meditation each day and both sessions. Then every year to try and do a 2 or 3 week retreat, solitary retreat. And often, Well, once a week we could meet with the Dalai Lama directly, either Monday or Friday. He gave open, in the early days, he gave open audiences to Westerners, so we could go up and anyone had any questions they could ask. And a couple of times a year he would give large public discourses, sometimes to 200,000 or 300,000 people at a go, and those discourses would go from like 10 or 11 in the morning and usually until 5 or 6 in the evening and last anywhere from 10 days to 2 or 3 weeks to a month.
Wow.
Sort of very intense, but very beautiful with, you know, exotic mountain peoples from all over, from Bhutan and coming out of Tibet and all these little lost Himalayan valleys. Sort of very exotic atmosphere, but basically you would just end up sitting down in the sun and listening to the Dalai Lama talk for 5 or 6 hours.
Well, here in the United States, you're so concerned when you go to school, especially graduate school, you know, the tests that you have to pass and the qualifications and everything. Did you have tests in your classes? And
Well, in the debate school, you debate for 4 or 5 hours a day. So really, you're tested for 4 or 5 hours a day.
My, that's grueling.
And then once a month, you have the all-night debate, which starts at sunset and goes till sunrise. And anyone can come up and challenge you on anything you've studied in all your time.
Oh, that sounds...
Anyone from grade one to the very top to the graduates and the postgraduates can come up and just challenge you on anything.
Well, that's a pretty grueling situation to be in.
It's a lot of fun. It's like playing chess with ideas, and once you get into it, it really has a wonderful feel about it.
Well,
and, you know, most of the Dalai Lama is trained in that same way. They call it Senyi in Tibetan. Senyi is the name of that way of training. And you have 2 or 3 hours of class a day, and you debate at least 5 or 6 hours.
Well, that's great, Glenn. We're going to come back and find out about your trip that you're going to be leading to the Sacred Mountain after this announcement. And please stay tuned and find out more about the Dalai Lama. Thanks for listening, and don't go away. Bye-bye. Welcome back to Solutions with Marilyn. We're so glad you're listening today. If you wish to sponsor this program also, call Clay, K-L-A-Y, at 253-584-1480. If you wish to reach me for counseling, intuitive readings, classes, or to contribute to this program, call me at 253-845-4907 or email me at Marilyn@angelicasgifts.com, one word. We're so glad that you're listening today, and don't want you to forget that next week we have Kimberly Clark Sharp from Seattle sharing her exciting near-death experience. You won't want to miss that one, that program either, so be sure and tune in next Wednesday again. We're going to go back and ask Glenn about his trip to Sacred Mountain. I hear you're planning one for June.
Yes, with Dharma Passages with on the web, dharmapassages.com, or also dharmatravel.com. Twice a year, generally, I lead groups into Tibet. And this June, we're going into Mount Kailash, the sacred mountain in western Tibet. For Hindus, Buddhists, and many other Asians, it's considered the center of the universe. It's the headwaters from the Ganges, the Indus, the Brahmaputra, and the Sulchi rivers, the four great rivers of West Central Asia or Southeast Asia, all originate from there. And it's the home of Shiva in Hindus and Chakrasambhara in Buddhism. And of the 24 great power places on the planet, it's considered the central piece of the navel of the earth. It's epithet in Tibetan. So we'll be going there. It's a fairly vigorous trip. Well, we fly to Beijing and then Lhasa. Spend about a week in Lhasa to acclimatize the altitude. Then we have to drive 5 days across the great desert of western Tibet, tenting on the way, and then we tent and walk around the mountain, the base of the mountain. But even the base is quite high, between 15 and 17,000 feet, many of the places. So it's an intense walk, but it's no mountain climbing as such, of course.
Well, it sounds like it'd be a great trip to take.
Well, every Hindu and Buddhist wants to make it there once in their lifetime. It's considered You know, it's the greatest natural power spot on the planet. And this year, being the year of the Iron Horse, is considered especially significant. So going once this year is like going 12 times.
Ooh.
So you really get your money's worth.
That's what I was thinking. As you know,
in terms of karmic bang for your buck, this is the year to go.
Well, that's terrific. Do you have many Westerners go with you on these trips?
Well, usually my groups are between 10 and 15, maybe a little smaller this year, and kind of, you know, the international conflict that's in motion. But so it could still commence between 10 and 15, depending on how things go in the next couple of months. You know, a lot of Americans are kind of timid international travelers. I mean, actually, America's one of the most dangerous countries on earth to live in.
Isn't that ironic?
But everyone prefers to die at home, so. It's a pretty safe trip, and it goes in through Beijing, and, you know, China's a totalitarian government, so law and order is a fact of life enforced with an iron fist. So things are very safe from that side.
Well, that's good to know. If people wanted to reach you for this trip, they could call, email you, couldn't they?
Yeah, you can email me, glennhmullen@yahoo.com, Glenn with two N's, Mullen with an I, glennhmullen@yahoo.com. Or just go to dharmapassages.com or dharmatravel.com, and you'll find a link there. Dharmatravel.com has up a page on some of the trips and has photos and stuff like that.
Oh, that'd be good. They could check it out ahead of time. And
otherwise, my other trips are, I may take one in the autumn. I usually do. This year, I'm not sure on kind of the international conflict stuff, if I'll take it or not, but probably will. And that's a more easy thing. We just stay in hotels everywhere and no tenting and rigorous drives or rigorous walks.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of for your happy traveler.
Are these also instructional trips where you teach?
Oh, yes, we meditate in each of the temples and do mantras in each of the power places and meet the monks and nuns in these places and chit-chat with them and have them give little talks. And it's basically a spiritual experience.
Oh, I think that's wonderful. I've gone on several spiritual tours. One's coming up for me shortly, but I have meditated in the Great Pyramid, and if people haven't done that kind of thing, they are missing out,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, certainly.
Oh, we hope they'll contact you and want to be part of your group.
Well, we still have a few places left on the June trip, and we're leaving on June 10th,
mm-hmm.
flying to Beijing, Lhasa, and then after that, we'll drive and tent. So we have about 10 days in comfortable hotels and 10 days out under the stars.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
And a lot of it in Tibet. We're in the lowlands of maybe 12 or 13,000 feet, but then walking around the mountain, we go up to 17,5.
Wow, that's high.
But that's like the path, so it's not like the peak. You know, Buddhists don't believe in scaling mountains. They circle them.
That's interesting. Well, for us out in the West, Mount Rainier is the highest mountain we have around here, and it's not nearly as high as what you're talking about.
Right. No. There's no mountains out there. Those are little bumps.
Oh, okay. Our bumps out here aren't very high. Oh, goodness. Can you share some basic spiritual teachings of the Dalai Lama with us?
Well, the best is if people buy my book, The 14 Dalai Lamas, A Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation. With each Dalai Lama, I do put in some of their, I translate and put in some of their quintessential teachings.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if one were to abbreviate it, the first meditation is on the preciousness of life, how your life is more precious than anything else, the human life form, and we can so easily become fully enlightened beings, great mystics and great spiritual beings, but we can at the same time misuse it because it's such a malleable life form that we can go from, we can go to the very highest or we can go to the very lowest with the human spirit. It's the most malleable life form in the universe, or one of the most malleable. So the first kind of teaching is to appreciate how the organic nature of the human spirit is something you can really capitalize on and use your life to become like a Buddha, like a saint, like a great being. Or you can just let it all slip away, or even worse, use it badly and just tie it all up in knots and turn yourself into basically an instrument of cruelty and negativity. Probably that's the first. The second is the idea of karma, that everything you do has an effect. It impacts the universe, and that impact is your connection with the universe. Nothing you do is lost, and nothing that happens to you comes from nowhere. We are continually creating our own universe, and what we experience tomorrow is the natural fruition of what we create today. And so it gives a sense of the continuity of being. Probably the third thing is death and dying. What it's all like to meditate on death and dying, to realize that everyone you know is soon going to be dead. Everyone before you is already dead, all in the future. This is the great equalizer. And if you understand it well, your life becomes rich and powerful. If you ignore it, you very easily move into superficial realms. After that, probably Buddhists like to contemplate love and compassion. Just like you want happiness, all others want happiness. Just like you don't want to suffer, no one else wants to suffer. Whatever you want, probably everyone else wants pretty much the same thing, maybe in a different form, but in essence the same thing. So to try to develop love and compassion. In particular, Tibetans don't say other sentient beings, they say mother sentient beings, all sentient beings, each of whom in a past life has been a mother to me. And then they meditate on the way a mother is kind and like this. So the Dalai Lamas have all emphasized that very much. Whenever you look into another person, remember, in a past life they were your mother. They bore you in their womb, gave birth to you, cleaned you, raised you. You owe them that debt of kindness. And then, of course, the final point of Buddhism is emptiness, the great void, that all things really are a theater and have no real nature. What they appear to you is just dependent on your own perceptual processes. From their own side, there is nothing there that exists in the nature of how it appears.
Well, that's all good for us to understand and know. It seems life would go much better if all of us used some of that philosophy.
Well, every Dalai Lama has given those quintessential kind of messages. They've also combined kind of general enlightenment teachings with the tantric teaching, mm-hmm. how to tap into the primordial aspects of our being, the clear light and the radiant nature, the kundalini forces of the body, and the anger attachments of the mind, and how to use these in a dramatic enlightenment scenario.
Well, that's fascinating. I just want to make a quick announcement to my listeners who thought they were going to hear Frank Joseph today about Atlantis and Lemuria, and that program will be aired at a later date. So we haven't gotten rid of that program. It's just that it didn't work out for today, and Glenn was kind enough to step in and help us out.
I pulled a coup d'etat.
You did.
He's tied up with duct tape in my basement.
Oh, is that what happened? Well, it was a wonderful hour with you, Glenn. I know that my listeners were thrilled to hear what you had to say. It was so enlightening and informative, and we were all intrigued. So thank you so much for joining us and being with us today, Glenn.
Well, again, very wonderful to be here and to speak to you and, to your people. And again, if you want the book, it's The 14 Dalai Lamas, A Sacred Legacy of Reincarnation by Glenn H. Mullen, myself. You can order it through a local bookstore or through Clear Light Publishers in Santa Fe at 800-253-2747. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Marilyn.
Bye-bye. Have a great day.
You too.
And if my listeners are so interested in contributing to this program and keeping it on the air, please call me at 253-845-4907. Or email me at MarilynAngelicasGifts.com.
You've been listening to Marilyn Solutions. Listen again next week for another informative show with guests from coast to coast. For a copy of today's program or a copy of her new book, Roses Have Thorns, and videotapes on empowerment and spiritual tools for healing domestic violence, write to KLAY in care of Marilyn Solutions, 10025 Lakewood Drive Southwest, Tacoma, Washington, 98499. Or visit her website at Marilyn@AngelicasGifts.com.
Many people are looking for a new direction and a lift in spirit. Hello, I'm Reverend Marilyn, a counselor, teacher for over 30 years, and a spiritual advisor for addictions, codependency, domestic violence, past lives, and holistic healing. Join me every Wednesday at noon for Marilyn's Solutions, a program sure to be of interest to everyone. We will talk with guests from coast to coast, offering a wide range of talents and information. That's Marilyn's Solutions, Wednesdays at noon on your news and information station, KLAY 1180.